As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Would you like to become the headline sponsor of the smartest football podcast on the planet? Would you like to be front and center on the Athletic Football Tactics podcast alongside Michael, Mark, and Liam and Ali? Would you like to reach hundreds of thousands of highly engaged listeners every month? Yeah, of course you would. Well, your brand can advertise with us now. Our skilled and charming commercial team are waiting to hear from you. Contact partnerships@theathletic.com. That's partnerships@theathletic.com.
Hello, welcome back. This is the Athletic Football Tactics Podcast. Thank you for joining us. Thanks for having us in your ears this week. I'm Ali Maxwell. Today I'm part of a four-man box midfield, similar to the one being popularised by Mark Robbins' Coventry in the Championship. I'll sit in the pivot and try and set the tempo. Ideally, won't have to do too much apart from just receive and recycle it. Mark Carey's alongside me. He'll be screening, he'll be blocking passing lanes and hopefully providing a Thomas Souček vibe, sort of supporting attacks from deep and attacking crosses when necessary. In front of us and responsible both for creative quality and for executing our complicated and unpredictable pressing triggers, Michael Cox and Liam Thumb. Hi, guys.
Hello. Why did you go for Souček?
I'm tall. I look
he like looks a bit vaguely Souček. Like Thomas Souček.
He's quite an unglamorous player, especially this season.
I genuinely just thought of tall central midfielders and Thomas Souček sprang to mind.
Normally it would be Per Mertesacker, but we'll move on.
You wouldn't bother wasting time with such a frivolous introduction, I think it's fair to say, Michael. Yes, so today it's the first part in a two-part series, broadly titled The State of Football Management in the Premier League. In this episode, part one, we're going to look at managerial cycles. We're going to talk about the hire and fire world of football management, how much that has changed and got worse, if you consider lots of managers getting sacked to be worse. And we'll attempt to establish how long the optimum tenure of a Premier League manager is these days. Michael, this has come from something that you touched on last week when we talked about Ralf Hasenhüttl and his tenure at Southampton.
Yeah, pleased you were so interested in it. But yeah, I think sometimes that we always judge managers by how things end. And they tend to end badly, especially at the Premier League. It's a little bit different Championship, League One, League Two, because you can go up in the world. Premier League, it's not really a feeder league to anywhere now. It's not certainly not a feeder league to Serie A or La Liga or anything like that. So, yeah, it tends to be that managers get sacked. And Hasenhüttl is a good example of people thinking, yeah, it didn't really work out. But for a while, I think he punched above his weight with a good squad. And the length of time he was there, I think he was the third longest serving after Klopp and Guardiola. I think he can consider himself did a pretty good job.
A big part of your discussion of Southampton both last week and then in a piece this week has centred around the sort of almost the gravitational pull of the relegation zone in the Premier League, and how for a team in the mould of Southampton, even just maintaining a level of mid-table in the Premier League is incredibly difficult over a long period of time. On the piece, you expanded that into something that was a little more, you know what, relegation doesn't have to be the worst thing in the world.
Yeah, I mean, we talk about it in such big terms, like the fight for survival, I think, is always a little bit OTT. Obviously, it's not like Southampton doesn't want to go down. But I just look at the squad and I think that's a kind of squad that if you just have, you know, a positive environment, winning games most week, there's a chance to shape that into something that can come up and, you know, potentially finish mid-table. I think when you're constantly scrapping for your life and when managers are constantly changing shape to react to the opposition, I mean, on a different subject, but I was looking at Bournemouth's formations they've used this season, and they're just changing it every week. They're going five at the back every other week against big sides, and they just don't have their own identity. And I think that can be really tough to form when you are in a spiral of constantly losing games over a period of time, like Southampton have, not just this season, but I think five seasons in a row, they've lost more than they've won. They've conceded more than they've scored. I think it's difficult to really build something long-term in that environment.
Do you think there's something to be said there for having quite a young and fairly inexperienced team as well? Especially a lot of the recruitment they did was picking up young players. Someone like Bazunu probably needed a step between going from League One probably to the Championship and then the Premier League, that they're sort of maybe doing it the wrong way around. But yeah, these are young players that you could develop into probably good level Premier League players. It just might take 2, 3, 4 seasons.
Yeah, and so I definitely wouldn't say the same about Everton, for example, yeah, because, you know, financially they've got to fund a new stadium, they've got a lot of players on big wages. But yeah, Southampton, it's not like the team's going to get torn apart if they go down. So yeah, I if they do go down, I would be fairly confident they'll bounce back, as Burnley look to be doing in quite spectacular fashion this year, with a reset that wouldn't have happened if they were still in the Premier League.
I have a friend who's an Aston Villa fan. They got relegated after 6 years of circling the drain, and the amount of bad feeling in that fan base and apathy and anger towards the board in particular, and it was just really negative. It was difficult to watch, and they went down to the Championship, and albeit he'd probably say we were there one season longer than I would have liked, still really enjoyed travelling the country, just doing different things and seeing his team win. I think it's interesting. I think it's a very interesting piece that you wrote there, Michael. Let's talk about managerial tenures in the Premier League. Where are we at with our current set of 20? Michael, who's the longest serving current Premier League boss, and how has length of tenure been trending in recent years?
Yeah, looking at the stats, maybe slightly surprising. There's four managers who've been there for more than 4 years. Two of them are obvious, Klopp and Guardiola. Came in 2015, 2016. Obviously, both have had great success. There's also Thomas Frank, who steered Brentford up to the Championship. And Brendan Rodgers as well, who's done a pretty good job at Leicester, missed out on the Champions League a couple of times, but generally punching above their weight, and of course won that FA Cup as well. There's two more, Arteta and Moyes, who've been there more than 3 years. But after that, it kind of tails off quite quickly. And the midpoint, so kind of the 10th and 11th longest serving managers, are Antonio Conte and Eddie Howe, who've been there for 1 year and 120-ish days. Mm-hmm. So 1 year, 4 months. And of course, if you look at the Football League, where obviously managers are often moving up through the leagues, it's even more of a kind of short-term situation. So the midpoint there, I think the 46th, 47th managers were appointed after the end of last season. So, yeah, in general, you're not getting much time at Football League clubs.
Yeah, that's certainly true. There's quite a few Championship clubs that have already sacked two managers this season, a la Southampton. And how different is where we're at currently to 10 years ago, Michael, to 20 years ago even? I feel like the obvious assumption is managers get sacked more regularly, their tenures are much shorter than they used to be. Is that true?
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's actually quite difficult to find definitive stats historically for managerial tenures. But just looking at how many managers are sacked in the year, per year for the Premier League, it used to be about five-ish a year in the kind of late 90s, start of the 21st century. Now it's up between 7 and 8 a year. And it seems increasingly common, actually. I mean, what you mentioned just now, that a club will sack two managers in a season, that used to be completely unheard of. Whereas now with Southampton, you really weren't that surprised it happened. And there used to be a big difference between England and other countries. I mean, we used to look at Italy and think it's mad. I mean, you'd have like 15, 16 managers a year getting sacked. That used to be a completely different world. And now I think it's kind of converged, you know, in terms of the styles. I recently reread some of a really good book, I think I mentioned quite a lot, called The Italian Job by Gab Marcotti and Gianluca Vialli. And the way that they write about, so this came out in about 2006, 2007. And the way they write about English managers from an Italian perspective is hilarious. Mm. I think they use the phrase, they're pretty much like civil servants. They can't possibly lose their jobs. Which, yeah, is absolutely not the case today.
I still think to a certain extent it is still true with Serie A. I looked at some numbers which, granted, are almost to the day 1 year old now. So it's a report from the CIES Football Observatory. And as of March 1st, 2022, the average Premier League tenure was 772 days, which so just a little over 2 years and 1 month. So compared that to the rest of the top five European leagues, it's 628 days in the Bundesliga, 617 days in La Liga, 385 days in Ligue 1, and 384 days in Serie A. So Italy is still the lowest, only just, and is, as I say, is a year old now. But the trends still sort of exist in that regard.
And what you do still have in Italy that you would never get in England is you get managers who get sacked and then reappointed by the same club a few weeks later. So I believe that might be about to happen with Daniele De Rossi, who's in Serie B. He got sacked, I think, 3 weeks ago with Spal, and they're potentially going to bring him back, which is just madness.
I wonder if there was ever a season in which Palermo sacked more managers than the whole of the Premier League or something like that. That's definitely a theme of a certain period of Serie
A. Or made more sackings rather than more managers, because it'll be the same manager like three times in the season. So one reason why this used to happen in Italy, and I think is still the case, is that managers were essentially cup-tied. So they couldn't coach more than one club in the same division in the same season. So you would sack a manager and get someone else in, then sack him and think, well, there aren't actually any candidates, so we're just going to have to get the previous guy back in. I believe that rule is still in operation, but please correct me if I'm wrong, any listeners.
Now, I'm interested in things like that. I've often wondered if one of the... there could be the trial of a rule of managerial windows, basically, in order to try and make things a little bit fairer for managers, basically, because it doesn't always feel fair for a manager with the heightened expectations, which we'll talk about in a second. But maybe the concept of only being able to sack your manager in a couple of parts of the season so that you're not getting into these ridiculous cycles. I don't imagine it will happen, but I wouldn't hate seeing it trialled at the very least. In the old days, we had Sir Alex Ferguson and Arsene Wenger, whose managerial tenures at Manchester United and Arsenal stand out not just in the modern era, but almost across English football history. Michael, did they kind of ruin it for everyone else because they were the two biggest names?
Yeah, probably. And there was also this, I mean, Ferguson was an interesting example because he did struggle and there was a point where he was on the verge of the sack and they gave him time and he turned it around. But when it was the two of them and they were the two kind of top managers and they'd both been there 10 plus years, it became this thing like, well, you know, Arsenal gave Wenger loads of time. But I mean, Wenger won the league in his first full season. So I didn't think that really applied. But yeah, there may be a myth developed that all managers got that long. And I don't think that was ever really the case.
I think what's interesting with Alex Ferguson is the extent to which his teams slowly evolved over a period of time. And he's spoken quite openly about that in bringing in sort of one or two sort of key signings and also a case of sort of letting players go at the right time and not maybe being too sentimental with players and actually saying, okay, maybe you've gone past the peak, let's let you go on and being prepared to sell players. Of course, famously, he gets this thing of being a real stickler for rules and you know, having his ways of doing things. And then, of course, Cantona is the one outlier of, he had all these rules and these ways of doing things and then let Cantona have the free reign. So very much having his approach of doing things and Wenger as well, very much being sort of an overseer. But I think you're always going to get these exceptions and they are exceptional in terms of their longevity, in terms of their achievements. But when you use that as the bar, then it makes things very difficult because people just aren't going to be able to compete to that. Football has also probably moved on in terms of style, in terms of what the coach needs to do and how it works. They are, of course, Wenger in particular, you know, supposedly these big pioneers of bringing in sports science and these other facets of the game now, these other areas of coaching, which we or I in particular take for granted and are used to as part of football that just weren't the case sort of 20 years ago. So I guess now they were very successful for what the coach or the manager could and needed to be then. It's probably a different remit now and comparing them, it's probably like when people compare players from, you know, now to 30 years ago and say, well, the game's different. They're not entirely comparable. They're a bit apples and oranges to a degree.
I think you make a good point about the evolving in small doses as well. And I think that Ferguson definitely did that at the managerial or coaching staff level as well, where you could think of it as a small period. So he had obviously Steve McClaren, there was René Mullenstein, there was Carlos Queiroz, all people who became managers subsequently in their own right as well. So while the Ferguson in this case was he had the longest stint in the history of the Premier League, there were sort of subsections whereby he had sort of managers in their own right alongside him as well. So it's definitely worth acknowledging that within what is a longer period for him at the club.
Yeah, the switching of assistant managers, Michael's always talked about when it comes to Ferguson maintaining success and backing up success with more of it. But then Arsene Wenger didn't do that sort of chopping and changing approach with his backroom staff. He was very loyal to them. And I dare say, if you were to look back at Wenger's career at the good times, one of the things you might point to was a really strong core and a lot of loyalty within that. So, you know, as ever, there's no one way to skin a cat. We probably see that with Pep Guardiola and Jurgen Klopp nowadays as well.
Yeah, I was always intrigued by the assistant thing at Manchester United because it was kind of circumstantial. I mean, Brian Kidd left to take charge of Blackburn, Steve McClaren left to take charge of Middlesbrough, Carlos Queiroz was left to take charge of Real Madrid, which was quite a big step up from assistant to manager of Real. So it happened organically. I'd be interested to know whether Ferguson would have done that if they hadn't just left off their own accord.
There's a clip that does the rounds quite a lot at the moment, which is Pep talking to Rio Ferdinand. And Rio says, how do you do it? How do you keep going year after year? Because I know what Fergie did, but I'm interested in what you have to say. And he goes, you have to change. And he's talking about the players. And he, over time, has decided that that is incredibly important for his teams and for the way that he plays in order to maintain their level, which I think is quite interesting. And comparing to Liverpool, perhaps they maybe haven't had... They haven't necessarily been as front-footed in player turnover over the last few years.
I think to a certain extent, it's also just the physical demands of Guardiola and Klopp in terms of just what is asked for them, whether that is, well, yeah, physically in Klopp's case, and of course physically with Guardiola's case, but also just the cognitive demand of players to concentrate as much on what Guardiola is asking for them. I think that comes into play as well as, kind of as you say, simply just getting yourself up each season to have the desire to win when you feel like you are kind of already at the top of the pile. There's obviously going to be variance within that. But I think, yeah, the demands that the manager places on them physically and mentally also come into play there.
And let's not forget how difficult it is now to win a league title. We're seeing teams constantly get into the high 90s on points and come second, which is quite incredible when you compare it to teams sort of further on down the years that you could have got away with a lot less points and won the league. Arsenal, for what it's worth, had a look this morning. Their current points per game, if they are to win the league, is on track to be 91. So again, that's going to be another team up into the 90s, and we expect City to push them pretty close. And at the same time, at the other end of the table, the points to avoid relegation is dipped compared to sort of early in the Premier League's sort of lifetime. There was a point a few seasons ago where Fulham went down as the 18th place team with 28 points, but you're looking at now what was once the magic 40 when I was growing up to stay up. You only really need 36 to maybe 38, and that should see you sort of fairly comfortably clear. So that has definitely stretched it away. Teams at the top now, I guess, that are really trapping for the title, you have so much more demand to be perfect and not get things wrong. And the same at the other end, that I guess these points and these wins are so hard to come by that you're going to lose more. And I guess if you lose more at the bottom, that's going to make you more inclined to sort of get sacked. So it's more, I guess, a bottom teams turning losses to draws and for top teams turning draws into wins. And I wonder if we'll come to a point where that plateaus or if that keeps sort of trending in the opposite directions as it is with budgets and whatnot.
Well, as Liam has mentioned, Ferguson, Wenger, Guardiola, Klopp, these are really the exceptions. These are the outliers. I guess the meaty part of the discussion shouldn't really take them into account. We're basically talking about all the other teams in the Premier League that don't have the budgets and aren't winning the titles, and how to work out how much a manager is doing, why they are effective, what their expectations should be, and therefore how long they should be the manager for when things aren't going so well. Michael, it's obvious that the job of a manager is different to what it was 20 years ago. Can you try and detail that for us, make a distinction between what a Premier League manager has to do now versus what they did 20 years ago?
I think it's changed massively. And I think, to use a bit of a weird analogy, I don't know if this works, I think they used to be like a head teacher and now they're just like a class teacher. Do you know what I mean? They used to oversee absolutely everything at the school. It'd be a long-term job. And now they're kind of doing very specific things with a particular group of players. And at the end of the year, or maybe 2 or 3 years, the players kind of get sick of things and feel like they want to move on. They don't have... I mean, it's funny. If you look at... So for kind of book research, I did kind of read a lot of autobiographies of managers in the 1990s. And a lot of them keep on repeating this phrase. They say, as a manager, you're judged on your signings, which absolutely wouldn't be the case now.
Right.
Because people know that it's not just managers. It's, you know, it's a transfer committee, the sporting directors. But that used to be one of the fundamental parts of management. You would get players in. You'd have to be a good judge of a player. You wouldn't have stats. You wouldn't have all the scouting software. You had to go and find players. Even in that respect, just the composition of the squad, things have changed completely.
I think on the note of the class teacher and head teacher analogy, I do think it kind of feeds into how long a manager has a stint within the club, whereby if you were to ask a GCSE teacher to teach a class for a single term and then you were to maybe test them mm-hmm. at that point, they wouldn't know everything they need to know for that year and for that exam. Whereas if you had them for a year, or it wouldn't work necessarily within a class teacher, but for multiple years, then they would get stronger and stronger. They'd build that relationship and they'd know more about the topic. And I do think it does have kind of parallels in terms of if you're asking a manager to get across their philosophy, yeah. their ideas, or the sort of cliches, then if they're given a matter of months, then that's just not going to happen quite in the same way. So I do think it kind of holds in that regard.
I think that will then impact style as well, because if you go in knowing that you've got a period of time to work with, you're going to approach things in sort of very different ways, that what you will prioritise in terms of development or results. It's one of the reasons why I think Mourinho is incredibly successful, but also can't really work long term, because his sort of way of doing what feels like quite a siege mentality of backs to the wall, you know, we're going to be a nasty team, a team that plays good football but is really good at sort of like winning games, that we don't really care too much about the long term, is great in the short term. And I see why that must really galvanise players, especially off the back of maybe poor performances. But I think that's just really hard to sort of maintain and do for 3-4 years. And of course, he's famously not really gone beyond multiple seasons, but has taken a lot of silverware. So it's really comes down to debate. And I guess we'll get onto the owners and stuff, but the people at the very top in the hierarchy of what do you really care about? I think a lot of people say they care about the long term, but will get annoyed and will sack a manager if they don't win in 5-10 games or they don't win a trophy. So I think people genuinely care more about the short-term success than the long-term success. And that's not necessarily a problem, but I think everyone convinces themselves, no, we really care about the long-term, but they don't. And maybe that's fine.
Yeah, the phrase, everyone has a plan until you get punched in the face, springs to mind in this discussion. Just going back to Lampard and Gerrard, I'm interested that you brought them up and specifically talking about the support that they had on their coaching staff. Michael, that strikes me as certainly how I perceive a lot of the very famous Premier League managers from the 90s and the early 2000s. I'm sort of loath to name too many names, but there are a lot of stories, whether apocryphal or true, of certain managers at that time who had incredibly long and successful careers, mostly spending their time in their office watching horse racing with the Racing Post, while their coaches that they'd hired did the ugly stuff on the pitch and did the training, and their job was essentially to deal with the media, present a certain image of the club, and be the sort of discipline head teacher, if you like. That strikes me as almost the path that Gerrard and Lampard were going down, as I understand it, but maybe almost in the wrong era.
Yeah, and it's interesting that those two, I mean, I completely agree with what Liam says. It's interesting those two assistants, Morris and Beale, clearly have managerial aspirations of their own. And I think the managers you're talking about, Ali, often weren't really like that. They had dedicated assistants. And I do think it's interesting as well, you mentioned the media side of things, because I think that's an element where a lot of people who just want to be assistants don't really want to be a part of. I remember when Graham Potter was at Brighton, and during COVID, he wasn't allowed into the games. And so his assistant, Bjorn Hamburg, had to do some interviews. And he was clearly completely uncomfortable with it. And like at the end of interviews, he was like, yeah, hopefully I'm not here next week. Because it's such a, I think the media thing is such a big element of things now. Because it used to be, I mean, 10, 15 years ago, if you're having press conferences and stuff, it's just journalists there. Like they're in the press conference, they write it down, that's that. Was now press conferences are streamed and they're put on YouTube and everyone is kind of like, everyone's a journalist now. Everyone can have a Twitter account, that kind of thing. So you've got to be really, I mean, I think you almost have to act like a politician now as a manager. And again, there's certain people, especially ex-players, who that just doesn't come naturally to them.
And I was speaking to Jay, our Brentford to Jay Harris, who was actually at St George's Park this week, partaking, well, he wasn't partaking on the pro licence course, but he was assisting on it. So his role really was to effectively grill and give these mock media or press conferences to coaches that are studying for what is effectively the qualification you need to be officially a Premier League head coach slash manager. And it's incredible that is now almost as much of a prerequisite of the course as it is to go out onto the grass and to coach effectively, or to have your understanding of analysis, sports science, etc. So it really shows just how much of a a central part of the game it's become. I remember Fergie saying at the end of his sort of United tenure that he felt he just effectively gave sort of copy and paste press conference answers because he didn't want to say anything that was wrong or that'd be manipulated, and he kind of just got fed up with it. Pochettino, of course, famously didn't speak English in his press conferences, even when he got to quite a level of fluency, because he didn't want his words twisted. I was actually at Everton against Aston Villa the weekend just gone, and I was amazed at how almost abstract Sean Dyche spoke, as someone who gets very much painted by the media as this very straight talking, honest, trademark English head coach, and was speaking in these terms that were 3, 4, 5 sentences long. And I'm sure he would say he wasn't really saying too much, and he was saying a lot of superfluous stuff that didn't always mean a lot. But I guess, yeah, there's a massive, it's part of the game now, right? They say that your game as a manager doesn't start at kickoff, it starts in the press conferences. You can use these as sort of mind games. And I think back to sort of old Super Sunday games on Sky where managers, that would be part of the compilation on the Super Sunday, would be what managers are saying, but yeah, before a game.
It does feel harder to control, I guess, for an individual manager than maybe it used to. And as you say, just the incredible breadth of scrutiny from social media and from an expanded media itself, professional media, I think must play a part in that. Like, again, I probably shouldn't keep going back to Ferguson, but again, he is relevant here. He really controlled that side of things, and it was a huge strength of his. He had quite a famous on-running dispute with the companies, with the country's like major broadcaster, and he was able to do that. He was able to have that level of control over basically how he was covered, which it feels impossible now for anyone to achieve that. The very best managers now, Pep and Klopp, they still get like laughed at weekly for things they've said in press conferences, and they're not really able to control that. And yet if you did just copy and paste answers all the time, the flip side would be, well, this bloke's so boring, how could he possibly motivate a team?
This is literally happening with Graham Potter now in real time, that he's being branded as someone who doesn't have enough emotion, and when you therefore aren't angry enough or riled up enough in press conferences and your team is suddenly losing games, it's, well, clearly, why would they have the motivation when this is the head coach that they have? Similarly, when it was at Brighton and we were doing well, it's, oh my God, look at how composed this guy is. They're beating United. They're beating these big teams because their manager's so composed, he's so relaxed. And I think, as Mark and I have spoken about a lot recently, that like this outcome bias can always sort of be fitted to say this characteristic can explain this however we want it to. And particularly within these managerial cycles, there's going to be a lot more nuance and a lot more things, I guess, that go on behind the scenes that we're actually going to attach to the manager. And they always say that their job is to come out and protect the players, that a manager might think it's his player's fault, but he's going to come out and he'll say, oh, I got it wrong today, or this is on me, even though it might be things that you look at and go, doesn't feel like it's in your control. But they don't want to throw players under the bus because they know how ruthless the media can be, and that is part of their job now, to protect the players.
And it's interesting as well, you look at how kind of Nathan Jones' departure from Southampton happened. That kind of all seemed linked to his demeanour in press conferences. I mean, I know the results weren't good, but like everyone was kind of laughing at his press conference or post-match interview answers. I bet most of those people couldn't name Southampton's back four. Mm-hmm. But like it was the press conference that went viral, which I find really weird.
And is it not, am I right in thinking with Scott Parker at the start of the season that there were supposedly rumours that his quite open expression about a lack of signings and a lack of sort of support and infrastructure from the board was one of the reasons for his downfall? So it doesn't feel ridiculous now that this is like the vessel from which people have to sort of consume this information. It's incredible, really, when you think about that.
Do we think that the rise in data analysis and, I suppose, tactical analysis, certainly the appetite for tactical analysis, has made the job easier or harder for managers as well?
It's tough. I think it's changed it. I think, they probably have to make more decisions every week. I mean, again, go back to the 1990s, managers would often basically just play the same 11 in the same shape every week, which obviously isn't the case now. So yeah, they are, I think, almost primarily tacticians and motivators now, and all the long-term stuff is less of a concern for them.
I think obviously with data and analytics, that's why I'm certainly in a job that there's more of a growth of that in the media, and it can be a bit of a stick to beat managers with. And I think to a certain extent, we spoke about social media as well, that everyone is a public analyst to a certain extent, and everyone then uses data and numbers to try and shape a narrative sometimes. And I think that can maybe go against a manager as well. But I think it was interesting, actually, just from a data perspective, to see some interesting quotes from Ian Graham, who is currently the director of research at Liverpool, but soon to leave his post, I think, in May. But he was basically presenting at a conference. It was the Financial Times Live Business of Football Summit. And he basically has outlined how Liverpool's underlying performance is not as bad in the data as many would suggest. And it was essentially that they were somewhat overperforming last season. He said that their season wasn't really a 90 plus points team last season. And this season, they are not quite as bad as they might look in the table, but the reality was somewhere in between. And I think that that's why you have data analytics teams within the club, but from the outside, people will maybe call for a manager to be sacked because their numbers maybe don't look good in terms of points per game, very much based on the outcome rather than the process. And that can then instill a bit of a panic from increasing social media, increasing the media's coverage of it. Then that puts the pressure on the manager, and it can go from multiple tweets actually reaching the press conference and actually reaching the manager, and then the board gets wind of it. And then it's funny how these things can kind of build and build from what maybe not necessarily what is kind of going on within the club and the performances on the pitch.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
A few aspects so far where the evolution of both football itself and the way that it is consumed have changed the reality for a manager. Michael, what about the people who hire and fire them? That has changed a lot in that time period as well. Not just the people that own football clubs, but also the amount of people now between owner and manager.
Yeah, that's a factor. And I also think the owners, I mean, they have changed. They've changed in the demographic. I mean, there's much more foreign owners now, which was almost a literally foreign concept 20 years ago. And I think back in the day, English chairmen were around the club. They were in the office every day, a lot of them. They were working with the manager. They had a very personal relationship with the manager. And I think in those situations, you can kind of build up trust and faith. And they were quite conservative in general. I think when football clubs are controlled by people who are, you know, often not attending games, not ever at the training ground, it's probably easier, you know, albeit through go-betweens, to just say, yeah, it's come to the end now, let's get rid of them. And yeah, of course, you have, you know, sporting directors. Almost every Premier League club now has a sporting director who has some responsibility a lot of the time for appointing the manager. And they are the constant. They are kind of seen, that is a long-term position. The first team coach is seen as more disposable.
I think on the note of firing managers as well, thinking about the finances of how much it costs to fire managers, you just think as well, for maybe not for the likes of Chelsea and, well, Chelsea, the most recent example in terms of how much money they're throwing around, but just how much money it costs to do that with the severance pay and things like that, that money could be so much better put to good use, whether it's even in a training ground, not necessarily actually spending it on the players, but just things like infrastructure within the club. And I look to see what the top 10 biggest manager payoffs have been in the Premier League. And when Antonio Conte left Chelsea, they paid him £26.6 million in a severance pay. And you just think, like, that's a heart. I mean, in the modern market, that's a fairly average player. But the point still remains.
That's 300 Michus.
Yeah, exactly.
Sorry, that used to be the measurement, didn't it?
You can still use that money. The point still stands across the whole of the league that you can still use that money to put to better use, essentially.
That would break the transfer record of numerous Premier League clubs, let alone sure. when you go down to Championship and further on. So, yeah, just to show that point of how the points are sliding in opposite directions at the top to the bottom, like that is why. And it's almost you have too much money to then be able to make really bad decisions like that. Some clubs down at the bottom might have to stick with the manager more because they just can't feasibly be sacking someone and paying all that money off. So they have to think a bit more smartly and go, well, let's maybe think about hiring a manager really carefully, and all of our other processes, yeah, they get a lot more sort of attention and due diligence.
So what I think is really interesting that is related to this and kind of goes back to my point at the start that basically all managers end up getting sacked and it ends badly and people remember it badly. Obviously, all managers have contracts and there's a contract length. It's very rare that you just get to the end of the contract and the manager leaves. I mean, who was the last one in the Premier League? I think maybe Allardyce at West Ham. He had like a 2 or 3 year contract. He got to the end of that and they were like, right, we're going to go our separate ways. But it basically just doesn't happen. You have to kind of constantly extend a manager's contract to show that you've got faith in him, to say to the players, you know, you can't just switch off and there's going to be someone new coming in. You never just get managers, you know, leaving on a Bosman, to use a kind of a player expression. So they just, you have to, like, they just get sacked eventually.
I love the sort of visual of 5 p.m. on the 30th of June when you finish your last day. You just sort of walk around the office shaking everyone's hands. Maybe someone's, you know, handed around an envelope for everyone to stick some cash in. Thank you for your service. It's just an amazing, amazing image.
Actually, another one I should mention is Roy Hodgson. Obviously, at Crystal Palace, he just came to the end of his contract, but maybe a difference, you know, he was quite old and I think they're just looking to move on. But like, it usually just doesn't really happen, does it?
On sort of the topic of non-English ownership, I'm particularly intrigued with American owners and knowing that a lot of their sports there don't have relegation, or it's not as much a key part. I think a big part of this topic we're on about is particularly managed at the bottom and the fight against relegation, and whether that's a sort of a sackable thing during it to try and keep a team up. It's what Leeds have done for the past sort of year or so. Southampton, Everton, other clubs are all, you know, making decisions around this based on that. And I wonder how much of a shift it is, just because someone who's grown up and been raised on that as a culture, if I was to suddenly be thrust into a situation somewhere in a part of the world where relegation wasn't a thing, I don't really know how I'd adapt to it. It would be really quite weird for me when there's suddenly a lot more sort of at stake where I know it's the same, I think, in Australia where they don't have relegation. It's just, and the same in the other sports, that you get people now because there's money and there's success that come from where, you know, sports in the NFL, where the prize is being sort of, you know, winning the good thing is winning the Super Bowl. It's not avoiding the bad thing. And I think particularly in the English game, there's a lot more fans that care about avoiding relegation that would probably be happier coming 17th on the final day than they would be ending up in mid-table, you know, and having a stale last few months, regardless of the fact you probably get 10 to 12 million pounds more. It's fascinating to me.
Yeah, I do think the existence of relegation is probably the strongest, most regular factor in relegation, right? I mean, the in the NBA, there was a coach that was fired a week or two ago, and he'd been there for something like 2.5-3 years, and there was a bit of uproar at how little time he'd had as coach. That was very unusual for someone to be sacked. They really don't sack to quite the same extent.
And in basketball, they play like every 3 or 4 days, right? Like the frequency of games is fast in my head. So it's not like in football where you might play once a week and then, you know, you've got, I think it's interesting this season where games are more condensed that, you know, apart from the World Cup break, you're going through games faster. So you've got more opportunities to lose. So if you lose 5 in a row, suddenly maybe you've lost 5 games in 2 or 3 weeks. But that to me is just crazy that would be not enough time.
Yeah, but because they don't have relegation, but if you are the worst team in the league, you have a better chance of getting the hottest prospect in the draft. Everyone is much more aware of, well, they're clearly, you get to a certain point halfway through the season where teams start to try and lose, essentially, or try not to win as much because it is just a better outcome for them overall. And they're making steps to try and make it less egregious because, tanking is just, it's a huge part of NBA discourse. Who's going to start tanking? And it's absolutely ridiculous and goes against the nature of sport, Michael. But you can also see why, you know, the threat of relegation makes such a big difference in this discussion.
Yeah, definitely. And it goes back to the Southampton point. Like, sometimes you go down and you can build something more positive.
And this is also the big argument, right, for why the Super League wasn't, or one of the many reasons why it was a bad idea, and football fans are vehemently against it, because you want jeopardy, you want, you know, the instance of failure and teams to have bad things happen to them as a consequence of, like, yeah, you make bad decisions and you get the negative outcomes.
Player power, how much does that have an impact, do you think? It often gets cited, doesn't it? They've lost the dressing room and the players have managed to communicate to sporting director or owner, essentially, we're not going to play well with this bloke in charge.
Yeah, I mean, it probably exists to a certain extent. I think one example is probably Chelsea in a few years ago. I think that the likes of Eden Hazard just downed tools, even though we knew that he was a player who at that time was probably at the top of his game. There's probably instances of it. I don't think it's maybe quite as common now, but I think it's interesting going back to the use of social media, that if not player power, then player awareness that things aren't going so well beyond outside the club itself is probably highlighted or very hard to avoid because of just how much players are on social media. They're on their phones constantly immediately after the game. They see what the response from the fans are. That it's hard for them to avoid that and see what the outside view is. And that then is likely to affect how they are, how they approach things within the dressing room. So it must be there to a certain extent.
I think football teams as organisations or as things are more unstable now than they were 20, 30 years ago in general. We're speaking about that with directors, with coaches or managers, how long they're in jobs. And looking at the numbers of the amount of money that's spent on transfers, and I imagine the frequency of transfers collectively are massively gone up over the past 10, 20 years. I imagine that means that it's not, you know, just more transfers occurring, but the same players probably going through more clubs, especially you see this at EFL level where contracts are very short. So I imagine there's also a big degree of player turnover, and just if players are used to things chopping and changing, they maybe aren't all seeking out or maybe not even used to. They maybe haven't even considered the concept of playing in a team that's the same for three or four seasons, because that just doesn't really happen. So they're sort of probably very prepared and I guess maybe not too attached. And the relationships are massively important. I think it's just now created a bit of a culture where players are probably used to a head coach going, and maybe some of them, if they are out of form or not in a coach's plans, probably don't hate it, because a new coach might come in 6 months of the season and say, oh, I'll, you know, the cliche is wiping the slate clean, go, you've all got a chance now. So I see that as a very realistic possibility.
But we only ever talk about player power in a kind of negative sense. It's always considered a real kind of like terrible thing about the modern game. But I think there's something to be said for it. Like, footballers often know the standards. They know the level that is required. And I mean, a year ago, you had this discussion at Manchester United. People were saying the dressing room was too strong and the players were kind of giving up on managers. But you had like Cristiano Ronaldo and Rafael Varane and David De Gea, and players who had won things. And you had, with the greatest of respect, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, who on a managerial level, you know, hasn't been at that level before. You had Ralph Rangnick, who's probably out of his depth. And you have players who kind of just almost saying to the board, look, we need someone better than this. And I think sometimes you just have to accept that's fair. You know, the other example is Chelsea under Andre Villas-Boas, who, you know, I really like Villas-Boas. Porto side was very good. He had been in the Chelsea dressing room before. But it was clear that the players just didn't really think he was up to it. And they got rid of him, and albeit in a very kind of unlikely situation, they did win the Champions League. So this whole thing that the manager has to be the most powerful person, the most powerful entity in the dressing room, I think is sometimes a bit naive. I think football is about the players, and I think they're allowed to kind of have their say about whether their leader's up to it.
A lot of clubs now also have kind of leadership teams as well, and it's quite common to say that the dressing room runs itself and things like that. That is a good example of it being positive, that these senior players do ensure that the rest of the team, the rest of the squad is falling in line. So, well, yeah, you're right. You can spin it as a negative, but it also does have a positive.
I mean, I did an article recently on Bobby Robson's season at Barcelona. An interesting thing happened there was that his captain left the club and he just appointed another captain. And the players were like, this is how it works. We vote on the captain. Mm. And I think that's an interesting shift. Like, he was obviously a very English manager who was like, I'm in charge. I, you know, work out who's going to be in charge in the dressing room. The players were like, no, we police it ourselves. And that was quite a big issue for him at the club.
Do you think we can try and nail down what we think is the sort of optimal tenure of a Premier League manager, Liam? Taking everything into account, what do you think is the optimal tenure?
I think from what we were discussing last week, I think 3 to 4 years / seasons is actually a very good period of time. I was fascinated when Zidane left Madrid really shortly after winning the Champions League. And I was really intrigued by what he said following that of, this is a team that should keep on winning and it needs a change for that. After 3 years, it needs another discourse, another working methodology. And that's why I took this decision. I was amazed because the foresight that must take it. I think there's a big degree of bravery to leave a team that is winning. And as Michael says, it generally ends with people being sacked and sort of fired. But I think football is hard to look at in cycles. I mean, a season naturally works, but is to a degree short term, especially in terms of sort of data stuff. It's probably midterm, but it's definitely not long term. I think in other sports, particularly Olympic sports, it naturally sort of does the work for you because anyone that's participating or coaching an Olympic sport will naturally work off of a four-year cycle. You'll have things like World Championships. You'll have, if you're in Europe, European Championships, Commonwealth Games interspersed within that. But you've got your big overarching thing of, we want to peak at that time. And football's very different because you're not trying to peak on a, you know, 3 or 4 times a year for a key event. You're trying to stay at a really good, like 80% level the whole way through. I don't know, maybe you try and peak for sort of cup finals or a huge game, but generally it's sort of, can we be at a decent level and avoid sort of crashing and burning? So I think that's why it's hard, because you've not got these points to go, what if we succeed in this event and this event and this event, we're good. It's no, we need 38 games in the Premier League to aggregate over being really good. And we actually don't know that until we get to the end of it. We might even get 4 games in the end that we might not quite know. So I think it's really hard. And then you get the hindsight bias of looking back and going, oh, if we hadn't dropped 2 points in this game in September, we'd have been higher. And you just, I don't know how you go about sort of retrospectively picking the bones out of that compared to at the time. Now, like Fulham are a great example with Silva saying, like, we've kind of hit our points target, but if Fulham lose like 10 of their last 15 whatever games, they also won't be happy. They might have been happy with that in sort of August, but your expectations, I think, probably change a bit too much.
I think the thing with Zidane that is really interesting is because, I mean, as you say, he kind of left saying that the side needs to kind of grow without me. But I think he grew without the team as well, because when he came back for his second stint, he was a very different manager to in his first stint. His first stint, he was very kind of Ancelotti. He kind of left the players to do their thing. He played simple formations. There was very little tactical innovation. Second time around, there were interesting rotations. He played Marcelo in midfield. He played Casemiro in a more advanced role. It was so much going on. I was really surprised by how daring he was in his second stint. And maybe that wouldn't have happened had he not had those 18 months, I think, off, away from the game, probably just watching other teams, learning more. Who knows?
You get those good old sabbaticals, right? When the managers go away, there's a big one for Eddie Howe and stuff, and Dyche sort of going.
Pep was playing chess in New York for about 6 months, wasn't he?
Dyche, it turns out, was like a Forest season ticket holder or something, watching sort of all their games. So, I think someone needs to do some more research into, you know, what does a manager do or a head coach do during a sabbatical, and when they come back and change things the second time around or in a new job.
They just annoy their wife is usually what they say when they come back. Like she just couldn't stand me being around.
Tripping over me at home.
They're clearly not doing that much actual work.
Michael, I feel like the concept of 3 years being the magic number for a manager at the top, that's been around for quite a long time, hasn't it?
Yeah, you can go back to Bela Gutman, the Benfica manager in the 1960s, who used to say that. And I think in more modern times, it's been Jose Mourinho, who has maybe not necessarily said it, but has kind of proven it with his length of time at any particular club. Yeah, there probably is something in that. It obviously depends on how they fare. And if you're at the top and getting success, I think obviously it tends to stretch. But it'd be interesting to look at how many managers are kind of with a mid-table club, do well after 3 years, and then kind of continue to take them higher. That feels relatively rare to me.
Well, I think it's been a really interesting discussion. And excitingly, it's been part one of two. This is basically a setup to next week, where we're going to basically pour petrol on top of this discussion. We're going to be asking things like, how important is a manager to a football team's success or otherwise? How much does a manager actually impact things? Why do clubs have such a low success rate in hiring managers, so much so that they then feel the need to sack the very managers that they hire, sometimes within months? Is there any way to predict which managers will do well or not using data or using history, gut instinct? And why do we as football lovers focus so much on managers when I think everyone admits there's also a lot else at play. Join us next week on the Athletic Football Tactics podcast. I'm really looking forward to that. And sign up to The Athletic today by heading to theathletic.com/tactics. So much good stuff on site at the moment. You can pay £1.99 a month for the first 12 months of your annual subscription if you head to that address, theathletic.com/tactics. Make sure you're subscribed to this podcast feed. You'll get part two as soon as it drops next week.
The Athletic.